your way to step on the accelerator, one way is with clenbuterol, binds and activates the beta 2s. If you want to release the brake, you need to inhibit the alpha 2s, and that's what uhimbine does and what rowulskine also does. So you can step on the accelerator and release the brake by using clenbuterol and uhimbine together.
What's up, guys? Welcome back to Muscle Minds with Scott Stevenson. I'm Scott McNally, and all of our programming is brought to you by you, the people of Patreon. Thank you guys for supporting our programming. We are also brought to you by TrueNutrition.com. You can use our code THINK on high-quality protein, high-quality intra-workouts like highly brain cyclic dextrin / cluster dextrin. Get wholesale prices over there, basically, versus getting it from a company that bought it from a company that bought it from True Nutrition. Also, we're brought to you by supplementsource.ca for Canadians. Of course, last but not least, I can't forget, we just had somebody comment the other day on Instagram. I got tagged in it. Somebody was very grateful that they bought the book, Be Your Own Bodybuilding Coach. You can go to byobbcoach.com, and I'll have links in the description. You can go and buy the hardcover. You can also get the hardcover on Amazon. Scott, what's going on, man?
It's Sunday, baby. It's time to do it. I guess this is fat burner day. The weather's getting warmer. It's always warmer I am, but it's like, okay, spring break, beach time. Like, it's the cyclical flow of questions.
Yeah. So thank you to September,
October, everyone wants to get huge, right? Everyone wants to bulk up. And I was like, oh my God, I got fat.
Right? Time to shred it down.
This is the bodybuilder version of the New Year's resolutioners.
Yeah.
You come in during January and then they're gone in a month.
It's time to shred down now. It's time to shred down.
Time to get shredded.
We got basically an entire outline from Ash over on Instagram. He DM'd us, and I thought to myself, hey, this is really a great topic. He put a lot of thought into a series of questions related to fat burners. And his first part was, he said, can you do a video on stimulants / metabolic stimulants? And from here, I'll give you the intro part. He says, use in contest prep. If they should be used off season and when to avoid stimulants. So, I mean, if we're going to get into that, should we first talk about the different categories of let's, instead of saying stimulants, maybe fat burners, Scott?
Yeah. Gosh, so many different things you've got things that growth hormones, secretagogues or growth hormone, which stimulates lipolysis. You've got things like someone asked about DNP. So we got DNP or usnic acid is actually out there as used to be something you'd get in a supplement as an uncoupler of oxidative phosphorylation. Then you've got stimulants. You've got compounds that would just stimulate the CNS and have an anorexic effect, not turn you into someone with an eating disorder, but limit your appetite. And that's going to have an effect. If it's easier to stick to your diet, you just eat less than you normally would, even if you were on a diet. And then you've got thermogenic effects, and those would come from stimulants that basically are sympathomimetics. So they mimic the sympathetic nervous system, which is what generally gets one of the main ways in which when we're on a diet, the sympathetic nervous system gets turned on to liberate fatty acids. So those can, from the adipose, if things are going right. So that those can be oxidized in place of the fuel that we're not getting in the diet. So, yeah, you've got growth hormone does it. And that's really growth hormone's identity as an exogenous hormone in individuals who aren't supplementing with TH, aren't using exogenous TH, is as a fuel regulator. So during exercise, we see GH go up. It helps with fat liberation. During sleep, we see GH go up. It helps with fat regulation. But it's not really acting in endogenous levels as to promote growth, per se, because your organisms aren't growing, unless you're someone who's got a GH disorder. You've got acromegaly. You've got some sort of a pituitary tumor or what have you. And then you're going to just keep growing because your growth plates haven't ever fused because of that continuous excess growth hormone. So we got that. The uncouplers, that's kind of you can see uncoupling in things that aren't direct uncouplers. So DNP, this is why everyone loves DNP, right? All it does is it creates inefficiency in the conversion of the fuel, the energy in your fuel, in your food, as it's converted into ATP. So basically it makes your mitochondria less efficient. So you have to oxidize and break down more fuel, more body fat, in order to get the requisite ATP. It works at a very, very basic metabolic level. The problem with DNP, I don't even really want to address that question. Like the lowest effective dose is because you can screw that one up. And I, you know, I've never prescribed that or suggested that with somebody that's, I always, you know, I know people do it and people get away with it. It also creates, as you know, you probably talked about this, I don't know how many times on drugs and stuff, right? And also blood, sweat, and gear, DNP, it creates free radical stress.
Yes.
Not the healthiest of compounds.
Yeah.
There's inherent in our metabolism is the production of some free radicals. Happens when we train as part of the training stress. It happens, the more oxidative phosphorylation you have, the more oxidative metabolism you have.
So like the, some production. The more you're dieting down, is that what you mean by that?
The, no, the more you're consuming fuel.
Okay.
So the higher your metabolic rate, there's some like 3%, 1%. I've seen up to one, between 1 and 5%. I don't think as high as 5, but 1, 2, 3%. I forget the exact number. But of the oxygen that would normally go to producing what's called metabolic water, so you oxidize your fuel. All these really cool transformative changes from potential into versions of potential energy to get ATP. And then hydrogen and oxygen combine to form water, metabolic water. But every once in a while, some small percentage, you get a superoxide radical. So you're producing, the faster your metabolism, the more free radicals you produce. So that's why, for instance, in the aging world,
yes.
In gerontology or looking at the biology of aging, you can do things like genetically engineer Drosophila melanogaster fruit flies to upregulate their free radical quenching enzymes, and they have a longer lifespan, so they live longer.
Yeah. Right?
So like one of the things, like I was just sort of thinking about this, caffeine was one of the compounds that does a number of different things, actually, but it's would be considered a sympathomimetic. It's a stimulant, a CNS stimulant. But there's some evidence, and I don't know the ins and outs of the epidemiology to poke holes in it and see to what extent this is mechanistic, but there's evidence that drinking coffee, and even in some of those studies, people were drinking decaffeinated coffee, but that coffee can increase life expectancy.
Really?
It's not going to change lifespan, I don't think. So lifespan, sometimes you see these words used. Sorry, I got a little puppy who needs attention now. Some of these words get used synonymous. So lifespan. Oh, sweet. You got a patron. Lifespan is in the gerontological world means for a given species, the long-livedness of that species. So how long could an individual in that species live? So I think 122 years is the record by a woman. And life expectancy is typically like a 50% of a given population has died off.
Okay.
So your life expectancy would be, you know, 72 for a human. But so increasing lifespan is different than increasing life expectancy. If you do things that are healthy, you don't smoke, you don't drink, what do you do? You're going to have potentially a longer life expectancy, but it doesn't mean that you're going to increase your lifespan. So coffee actually, maybe because it has these antioxidants in it, which we talked about a few podcasts back, might be somehow affecting life expectancy. I don't think if you drink coffee, you're going to live to be 150. Right?
Yeah.
But you know, there's potentially a lifespan impact there that manifests statistically as an increase in life expectancy, which is what the epidemiological research suggests.
You were kind of spinning off from DNP, and you had said,
right.
So you had said, though, and I just want to be clear here. And one thing, too, is that having coached for about 15 years now and obviously done bodybuilding for longer than that, having competed for a long time, I wanted to be able to also, I could share some of my real world experience with some of these things, pros and cons,
sure.
But just to be clear, DNP will not improve your life expectancy, correct? Is that what you're getting at?
I wouldn't expect that.
Okay, because I have heard somebody say that it'll actually improve your life expectancy and in your life, you know, that you'll live longer, that it's helping your to build mitochondria is what I heard this coach saying that. And I just wanted to be clear.
Yeah, there's probably impact on mitochondrial biogenesis because it creates an energy demand,
Okay.
So exercise creates an energy demand. We're getting more mitochondria because of that.
So you resistance so, exercise. But the conclusion then was that then you're going to it's going to be healthy for you to take it.
I think that's a false conclusion. I mean, my I would not expect that whatsoever for two reasons. There's a whole like longevity and the like theories of biological aging. There's like hundreds of theories that people have out there, right? And but a couple of the main ones, one of them is the rate of living theory. So the faster you live or the higher your metabolic rate, the shorter your life expectancy or the lifespan. Yeah. So you see this like in smaller animals don't live as long as larger animals.
Yeah.
Right. But there's some kind of exceptions to that. Actually, this is kind of funny. I'm remembering some things from long ago. There's also this free radical idea, and that comes from those experiments with animals that have been genetically modified to do a better job of quenching free radicals. So DNP increases your life, increases your rate of living, so to speak. It increases metabolism. Mm-hmm. That speaks against that general notion we see cross species, and it also increases free radical production, which would also not behoove you in terms of living longer.
Okay.
Because you've got more free radical stress or oxidative stress. There's it's kind of cool if you compare, I believe it's pigeons and parrots, they're roughly about the same body size. So you look across small to large animals and in terms of how long they live. And those two are if you compare them, I believe it's if I remember correctly, parrots have enhanced free radical quenching ability. They tend to live really long.
Yeah, they
pigeons
do.
Live like 2 or 3 years or something like that, right? And who knows, that may have evolved evolutionarily, but you know, because of where pigeons live, you know, a lot sure. of times they're in places where it's better to have a faster turnover to adapt to whatever's going on in the environment because it's less stable. Maybe they're living in urban areas or whatever. But anyway, so that's kind of an interesting little anecdote about the importance of free radical production. So.
Okay.
Yeah, I wouldn't take DNP expecting you're going to live longer. Especially, I mean, it just makes you feel awful, right?
Yeah,
there's so many horrible stories.
I ran it 2 times personally. I've never had any clients use it. And here's been my thought, Scott, just from a practical standpoint, is that I've been able to get people into like incredible shape, right? To mm-hmm. if you can diet somebody down to be the absolute leanest person in the contest, then there's no reason that you need to use DNP as well. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like we have plenty of other tools through starting out with diet and, you know, diet and cardio being the first two. And then from there, there's so many more options. And then there's the element of time too. The longer you do these things, usually it's the guys mm-hmm. who are in the best shape started out lean and then they dieted the longest. You know what I mean? A lot of times mm-hmm. that ends up being the case. My experience was using it in 2 different fashions. Once was early in the contest prep and, earlier, I should say, I was maybe 10 weeks out. And so I already was making progress and things were moving along. I was getting the fat loss I wanted, used DNP for, I think it was a short period, like 5-7 days. And I used S2H's mm-hmm. protocol with the fruit and everything else. When I came off of it, I had fast forwarded several pounds. I had definitely lost several pounds of fat through doing it. But then it took me another 2 weeks to get back into the groove that I had been in, which I feel like it just kind of, if I would have just, I sped up for sure. But then it took me a while to figure out, okay, well, what's my needs now, you know, now that I'm leaning,
right.
I wasn't able to track along for that period of time. So it interfered with my ability to track progress, slowing me down for a period of time. There was that. The other time I ran, it was very close to a show. And it was summer, like July, August in Michigan. Humidity is like nearly 100%. It's, you know, upper 90s, just can't breathe. And I was working a manual labor job, and I felt like I was going to have heat stroke every day. And my energy was just so shot. So I just think, honestly, I've heard of people running it for long term, you know, through like a whole contest prep, which is absolutely ridiculous if you ask me. And most mm-hmm. people, I think, just about everybody I know that I respect would agree with that statement that it is ridiculous. I don't think that it's needed personally. So that's just my personal take. Like I said, having coached for 15 years.
Did you hold a bunch of water when you're on it too?
I gained several pounds. It wasn't terrible, but I did.
Okay.
I did.
Yeah. So it's hard to tell, you know, much you're dropping down. It makes training really, really hard.
Yep.
Like going in there and maintaining a good training stimulus. Not that I'm, you know, suggesting supporting this, but some people would go in and they would just like, it's like they gain like, you know, 8 or 10 pounds of fat they don't want. And they just blast the DNP and try to like literally obliterate it in like 10 days and just suffer tremendously. And they're sweating yellow and there's, you know, all their sheets are getting destroyed and they got to change their clothes 3 times a day.
Yeah.
And it's just absolute nasty. And it's just not a healthy, it's not a healthy way to go about it.
No.
So.
No, but I tried it just because I wanted to know. I wanted to have the experience for myself and I wanted to talk about it. I was curious. And most of the time, the people who use it, that's what I end up seeing, you know, that they're, they say, I just want to know, I want to try it. But, you know, anyway, so where do we go from here? I would say that on the list of popularity, it's DMP nowadays is pretty low. You know, I'd put maybe Clen, ECA, those things being more at the top end of popularity. Mm. Would you agree with that?
I think so. Yeah. Although, you know, it's funny. There's a very Justin Musial is his name. He's a German bodybuilder who's going to get his pro card this year. Looks ridiculous. He's up and coming. I follow him online on Instagram and watch his videos. He's coached by Max Mattsson.
Oh, okay. And yeah.
2 years ago, I believe it was, they used DNP in his prep. Okay. And he ended up doing okay. I don't think they did it this time. They didn't need to. And it's kind of interesting because he's greatly improved. He had a great, you know, off season period. So, but he's coming in better shape. He's in better shape at like, you know, 4 weeks out than he was on the day of the show, even without changing his water.
Good for
without
him.
Having used any DNP, but I think they even put a book out in German on how to use it, which is kind of, you know, kind of risky in a certain way because, you know, you say, you know, this is the serving size. And so bodybuilders take 2.5 that, right?
Yeah.
So that's kind of the scary thing is you can, because of the long half-life, this bears repeating because of the long half-life of DNP, you know, if you do compound your doses daily over time, you could end up with a very, very dangerous dose that you really can't get out of your body. You're going to have to go to the hospital or put you in ice or what have you to try to cool you down because the thermic effect is just ridiculous.
And there's no anecdote.
There's anecdotes. There's no antidote.
There's no antidote. There's nothing you can take that's going to reverse that.
Not that I know of. No. I mean, it's phenolic, so it's lipid soluble. It just kind of disperses itself everywhere. And I don't know, like you could find something that would bind it up, you would probably, you know, kill, it'd be toxic as well.
All right. So let's move on to Clen then. What do we have to say about that? I know we did, we did a great topic on this like 50 episodes back, and I bet a lot of people didn't hear it. We talked about how Clen worked. We talked about how Yohimbine worked, and we talked about the combination of the two. Would you be up for explaining that again? Because I found that to be absolutely fascinating.
Yeah. Well, the part of the big question is off season versus pre-contest. You want to go into that first? The more global view is where they should be used?
We just spent 20 minutes on DNP. If we could do like 5 to 7.
Long.
Yeah. Oh no, we're 25 minutes in now. If we could do like 5 to 7 minutes on the different compounds out there, that's what I was thinking was 5 to 7 minutes on each compound. And then from there, maybe go globally, just to give people a picture of what's out there. Because when we talk about these things, my first thought is, well, what are we talking about?
Okay. My first thought is, do you need to use them in the first place? And my sense is, look at the natural guys who don't use any of this shit and they get shredded.
So we
just say that off the bat, right?
Yeah.
These are all icing on the cake that should be tertiary to the primary choices of your diet and whether you do cardio or not and everything else, you're counting steps and all that kind of stuff. So this is down the rank of the ladder. So when it comes to the sympathetic nervous system, somatopimetics, this is where the combination of Clen and even ephedrine, but Clen in particular and Yohimbine are kind of cool because they're specific tools. You've got, grossly speaking, alpha receptors to which norepinephrine and epinephrine combine and beta receptors, right? And the alphas are kind of, they put the brake on lipolysis and the betas would accelerate lipolysis. And this is really highly generic because you can find these different receptors in different tissue types, like skeletal muscle versus fat versus smooth muscle, et cetera, and you'll have different actions. But we're thinking mainly about adipose tissue. We're trying to liberate fats, so those fats would be oxidized then, and you dip into your body fat stores to lose body fat over the long haul. If you activate the beta receptors, in particular the beta 2s, actually the beta 1, beta 2, beta 3s, and adipose will all turn on lipolysis, but the beta 2s are where clenbuterol goes more specifically. That accelerates. That's like pressing on. This is the analogy I always use. It's like pressing on the accelerator in your fat burning car, right?
Yeah.
So you go faster. But there's also some binding that just happens from the endogenous other, from the norepinephrine that's there, the other, amongst the other, what's the word I'm looking for? Catecholamines. So norepinephrine, epinephrine. And if you bind and activate the alpha receptors, that puts the brake on lipolysis. So there's a mechanism in the cells there where you can up and down regulate those to control lipolysis and fat cell and regulate the fat. So you've got a brake in the alphas, in particular the alpha 2 receptors. You've got an accelerator in the betas, particularly the beta 2s. Your way to step on the accelerator, one way is with clenbuterol, binds and activates the beta 2s. If you want to release the brake, you need to inhibit the alpha 2s, and that's what euhimbine does and what rowulskine also does. So you can step on the accelerator and release the brake by using clenbuterol and euhimbine together. So they function as a nice compound, a nice 1-2 punch for producing more lipolysis. The more you can do that, the more you use it as a fuel.
That analogy works so good for me. Like I can totally picture that. It really does. Where does like ephedrine or ECA fit into that mix?
So ephedrine actually stimulates the presynaptic sympathetic nerve endings to release more norepinephrine. Okay. So it acts locally to increase sympathetic activity at the fat cells. It also has, of course, a central effect too on your appetite. From the studies, there's some really nice studies that are. Astrup was one of the people who did a lot of these studies with obese people, showing a nice effectiveness of ephedrine, just ephedrine in of itself. Then you combine it. There's one with caffeine too, but it was just a short term study. But with ephedrine long-term, it helps with fat loss. The impact on your blood pressure and your heart rate is, on average at least, goes away after some time. I think, practically speaking, most people can still feel when they take some ephedrine. There's a guy, I was in grad school, he's an endurance athlete. He was an exercise psychology student, and he was swimming a lot at the time. He was going swimming for like an hour and a half. And wow. He started reading about ephedrine, right? And he comes in, we're all studying in the study lounge, and he comes in, he's like, anyone ever take ephedrine? It's like, yeah, we think you have, right? He was hilarious. Right. He was just, he never had it before. He was completely naive to it.
Yeah.
So it acts a little bit differently. One of the questions was alternating between ephedrine and caffeine, and I've seen that work in all sorts of ways. The thing is, the sort of determining factor as to whether
you mean ephedrine and clen?
Yeah, what did
just
I say?
To be clear, ephedrine and caffeine, and I figured that's what you meant.
Oh, yeah.
I just wanted to be clear.
Yeah, no, actually, I meant ECA and clen.
Yeah,
because typically, what people would tell you don't need the aspirin in there, although it does prolong the effect. So it inhibits prostaglandin synthesis and will prolong the effect. And you can, if someone's taking, for instance, ephedrine and caffeine, and they're just doing EC, and then they throw in aspirin. If you throw in like an naproxen, people will notice immediately, okay, this lasts like twice as long.
Really?
Huh. And actually there's a study in rats too, where they gave tyrosine on top of it, because tyrosine is a precursor for the catecholamines. It increased the anorexic effect. So the rats ate less.
Really?
And they were also supplemented with tyrosine. So
I believe
the thing that happens to lots of people when they're doing ECA or just EC, or usually it's an ECA, but is they start to get run down over time.
Yeah.
And it may be that they're literally sort of becoming depleted at the sympathetic nerve endings of the norepinephrine. And you can supplement that with tyrosine, and people notice a difference. You feel the stimulant effect, it returns, and then the anorectic effects returns as well. Yeah. So
I'm a big fan of L-tyrosine. I've used it on every contest prep I've ever done, and I found a real good anti-fatigue effect from it. Between ECA and Clen, I personally found that, and some people like one, some people like the other, but I found a lot of ups and downs with ECA. Somebody asked with Clen, what if they split the dose up like through the day to prolong the effect? With Clen, isn't Clen a long half-life to begin with? Like, you don't need to dose it multiple times.
It does have a long half-life. Depends on how you're defining half-life, but people without a doubt get an acute stimulatory effect from Clen. Many people do.
Yeah.
So you take, like, let's say you're going to do, I don't know, you're worked your way up to 80 micrograms or something like that, right? If you do 80 in the morning, you definitely, it's like, oh, the half-life is 30 hours or whatever it's supposed to be. It's
right.
Be variable amongst people. You definitely feel that for the first 3 or 4 hours, the jitteriness and everything else that would come along.
For sure.
So you can break that up. I mean, I know people, I know one person in particular I'm thinking of who would take Clen right before going to bed.
Me too. I wonder if it's the same person. I tried it once, and there's no way I'll ever do it again because it was, I couldn't fall asleep. Like
of course
terrible.
Not.
It was terrible, man. But some people, they have no problem with it. They're like, yeah, I do it every night.
Yeah. I've seen that with yohimbine too. You know, like, oh, I just forgot to take it. So they just throw it in. They just chuck it in before they go to bed and they sleep just fine.
Yeah.
So that's one of the negatives too, was one of the further along questions in this sort of outline we were given.
So
we covered not to use stimulants.
Yeah. We covered so DMP uncouplers, and then we covered a bunch now with ECA, Clen, and yohimbine. Would we be good to move on from here, or maybe thyroid? Would that be like a last place to wrap up, saying that these would be the primary stimulant/fat burners that we use used?
Those are the main ones. I mean, yeah, there's terbutaline that people use, another beta 2 agonist. Albuterol, some people use albuterol. That one, you know, there is some evidence on albuterol being effective, just like clenbuterol too, but it just doesn't seem to be. There's to some degree, sort of, you separate the wheat from the chaff based on what ends up being used by people. And see, people too use albuterol, maybe because they can't get the Clen.
Yeah.
But you know, that works too. I think albuterol is also prohibited by WADA. Mm. Like clenbuterol in the animal research has an effect on muscle mass as well. So it has this repartitioning effect. So you lose body fat and gain muscle mass. You see it in livestock too. So like, that's one reason. It's like, you can build muscle with Clen. There was a guy, Justin Rice, R-Y-S, I think is how it's like. He went by Big Kiwi.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
On professional muscle. Yeah, he passed on, gosh, it's maybe 8 years ago now, so a while. But the guy was a maniac. Trained just like a friggin' monster.
Yeah.
I corresponded with him many, many, many years ago. And like, say, how's it going, bloke? You know, how's it going, mate? And he would say, oh, I got kicked out of another gym. I was thrown up in the corner. He's like, I think one of the stories was he was squatting or something like that. And he went and he puked in the corner, and then he went back and started squatting again. And I was like, I told the guy I was going to clean it up when I was done, but I wasn't finished with my workout. Right. So he just left the puke lying there, you know?
Yeah. He's going to lose his pump.
Phenomenal guy. What's that?
He's going to lose his pump if he didn't finish. Right.
Like, he was just a madman. He was extreme with everything.
Okay.
Like, he was one of those guys who ate, like, quote unquote, like 12 meals a day.
Yeah.
You know, like every hour he was eating a meal or something like that. And he was using like 500 micrograms of Clen a day.
Oh my God.
The numbers are, you can look as find his posts on professional muscle. I'm pretty sure he said he was like 500, but he felt there was a repartitioning effect. He felt like he gained mass from that and it helped keep him lean. A little pup trying to climb on my desk.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's one of the reasons why WADA ruled out or prohibited clenbuterol because it could help build muscle and be ergogenic in that. I mean, dropping body fat can be ergogenic too. If you're lighter, body weight dependent sports, the lighter you are, at least if it's not dead weight, the better off. But so, yeah, I think even in my PhD research, we disallowed people who were using albuterol or clenbuterol. Albuterol was being prescribed then for asthma.
Yeah.
I think it still may be. Yeah. So,
yeah. I got a prescription of it for it with my lung situation, and it didn't really help me a ton. Not like Clen was much more beneficial, but yeah.
Right. Yeah. But potentially it could impact things. So I think I had one person like, Rick, sorry, man, you can't be I'm not going to tell you to not take your medication for your asthma. That wouldn't be good. But, you know, we want you to be clean for like 6 months before you come in for any residual effects on, let you get back. Because, like, for instance, I mean, just as sort of aside, but imagine someone were taking albuterol and it was impacting their muscle mass. And they were, you know, because of long-term use, they had 3 or 4 or 5 pounds of muscle mass they didn't. And then you say, okay, well, I'll stop taking. It's out of my system in a week. And they come into your – and then they're losing over the course of your training study, they're losing those growth effects that they previously gained while you're applying this training stimulus in whatever condition they're in. And then the two things are negating one another. So you don't have someone who's got the same baseline as everyone else.
Yeah, I've worked with a number of people that were natural otherwise I mean, I can't say that they grew muscle in a contest prep, but man, it sure did give a nice visual effect. There's a slight drying effect to it too that I'm more personally a fan as a coach than I am of ECA. Some people like ECA if they wanted to use it. It's not like, you know, whatever, but I like that. There's kind of like that diuretic like effect of losing a little bit of water, looking a little tighter. And, you know, as far as the muscle growth thing goes of albuterol, good friend of mine, friend for years, Will, he has fascioscapular humeral muscular dystrophy. So that would be like the face, scapula, and humeral. So it affects all like up top from anyway, they prescribed him albuterol. It's been shown in studies for people with muscular dystrophy to help to reduce muscle breakdown. So they're, you know.
Interesting.
Yeah, so he had been
Does he have any breathing difficulties? Does it go far down as his diaphragm so that he has inspiratory insufficiency?
Not yet, but from what I understand, it's a progressive disease. And so with time, that is eventually what occurs. And that's generally what takes people out that have it is – They can't breathe anymore. So, yeah. But he's doing good. You know, he's doing good. I think he's doing everything he can.
Keep training, man. Maintain that shit, right?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Keep that reserve. So, you know, if he's got a VO2 max that is twice that of what it otherwise would be, he loses half of it because of the disease. He's still at where a normal person would be.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, that's the way to look at it.
So last but not least then, thyroid T3 and T4. What would you want to say about that? And then maybe we could go global with it.
Yeah. Obviously that would go down if you're not supplementing with it, exogenously, right? As you diet, like it can go really low. And some of the case studies with natural bodybuilders can go really low. We got a question about that. I think it was related to half-life, or at least it came up on one of the other podcasts, and I did a deep dive on John Meadow's site. Kind of plug John's site on that. So
mountaindogdiet.com.
Exactly. That's something you'd want to, ideally, right? You want to make sure your metabolic rate doesn't go down. If your metabolism is slowing, then you'd have to go into a deeper deficit to produce the caloric deficit. And the more you do that, the more your metabolism slows, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, when it comes down to a difference in 300 or 400 calories a day, euthyroid versus hypothyroid, that makes a difference over weeks and weeks of a diet. It could be even less than that, right? And the extent to which that happens varies by person. This is where blood work would be nice because the thing that, you know, that you see, you may have seen this. This doesn't happen with your clients because you don't allow this, but people throw in thyroid as a fat burner at the end, and they use too much. They throw in whatever, 100 micrograms or something, and And then they increase their metabolism everywhere. And then boom, they end up losing muscle mass. So they, you know, they have this horrible P ratio in the last 3 weeks, and they end up just looking really, really thinned out and over dieted, and they drop muscle, which was unnecessary. They got the body fat off, but they end up having a terrible look than they would have if they just dieted for 4 weeks longer and chosen a different show, if possible. So that's the thing with thyroid. It can be really, it's catabolic. But if, for instance, we compare clenbuterol, which doesn't seem, I just haven't seen any evidence in humans that it has this repartitioning effect, but in animals for sure, there's evidence, anecdotal evidence, for instance, from Big Kiwi, but that's a lot of clen. Don't do that, please.
Also, too, he was probably taking other stuff, so it's not like it was completely isolated, right?
No, he was, he was just everything, man. This guy, he was arrested. He was, guy was just, his recreational use was, I think, pretty crazy.
Oh,
he lived just hard, man. He guy lived hard. He's just one of those guys that was just on, like, you know, he was living like three times faster than anybody else.
Well, I hope hope he enjoyed it. You know, we only get this one opportunity. So if that's what he did, I hope that's the way he want. It sounds like it's the way he wanted to do it, you know. So in a way, more power to him, I guess.
There's a documentary out there about him, I believe, on YouTube, and he regretted it in the end. He didn't live past 40. Yeah, he regretted some of it. He ended up with, I forget what he was diagnosed with, but it was a musculoskeletal disorder of some sort where he was pretty much, and I mean, it's hard to say what caused what, because, you know, hardly anyone is doing all the shit that he did,
right,
doing the way he did, but he had a lot of health issues there at the end.
Poor guy.
He tried to fight it. You know, he kept on coming back and coming back. I was just, he had, you know, an indomitable spirit, but he, I think he regretted, because, you know, he had a lot of people that really loved and cared about him, and he left the earth really, really soon. So, you still see his pictures on the banners and stuff for professional muscle, because they want to kind of honor him. Just an awesome guy. Like one of those guys where he posted like what his clen use was or whatever he did, and people would come in, just, you know, guys that are half his size or whatever, typical, just bashing him, just saying these horrible things. And he was just like, you couldn't impact him. Nothing bothered him. He's like,
that's
okay.
Wild.
Yeah. He was just a wonderful, wonderful dude from what I knew of him. So, thyroid can, you know, and I see different opinions on this. I think I saw something from Dr. Dean St. Mark recently on thyroid. So, for instance, if regardless of what you're using, T4 or T3, you're going to shut down your own endogenous thyroid.
Yeah.
There's advantages to T4 versus T3 potentially. Check out Dean's post on this just from like 2 weeks ago. T4 is what sometimes is considered standard practice. You read that sometimes. Sometimes people use compounded both, because there's a good reason to have T3 in there, just because that actually is the active form. T4 is converted. The advantage of using T4 would be that you let your body convert the T4 into T3 based on its nutrient status. So you're not going to drive, especially if you're deep in a diet, you're not going to drive your metabolic rate excessively with T4. Than with T3, because T3 just slams on the accelerator, muscle, fat, everything, whereas T4 has to be converted. So that conversion will be driven by insulin levels, for instance, and your nutrient status. So you're going to supplement what's produced predominantly in the thyroid gland itself, and then let the body parse it out as needed. So that's a way to more subtly encourage a more normal euthyroid status.
But, yeah.
Yeah.
I found
the smartest way is to try to keep your thyroid like in place. If you're going to use thyroid, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but
that's right.
And then have that in place like 10, 12 weeks out. Right. If you're going to do that, and just have that that's a factor. And like, you don't got to do anything, because you know what's coming in. You're good there. And it's not like, okay, now I don't know what to do. I'm going to just slam a bunch of thyroid. You know, you're already good thyroid wise based on your blood levels.
Right.
And then you can manipulate other things.
That's kind of what I was getting at. That's what I've kind of leaned toward doing nowadays. You know, years ago, I think the first time I ran it, I got my information off the message boards, right? And so I started at 25, and I went to 2 weeks later, I increased, and then I increased up to like 100. And I did lose fat. There's no question on it. But I definitely kind of sized down in the process too. Mm-hmm. Wasn't the best diet to begin with, but anymore, and at the time there was a huge talk of you got to be on cycle if you're doing this, because you know that's what people would say, because you to fight off the muscle loss effect. But I found that nowadays, just a low dose, and the way I explain it is almost like a replacement dose. You know, like you said, natural mm-hmm. guys get their thyroid tanked. They get their testosterone tanked too. And if you were to diet down on just a TRT dose of, you know, testosterone and just a replacement dose of T3, or you could go like Dean was saying, T4 possibly. I've found T3, if they're not using growth, I'll go straight to T3 a lot of times in a prep mm-hmm. type situation. But just that little low dose, it's almost like the way I've seen it, Scott, and this is just me, my bro brain, is that as we diet down, our bodies want to resist fat loss at a certain point. You know what I mean? Like our body doesn't want to change. And I see that decrease of thyroid output as being part of that, like trying to preserve the stores that we have. But we can basically, I guess the word would be like hack that whole system by mm-hmm. ensuring that you have like a healthy, steady dose all the way through, regardless of what we're doing, regardless of if what we do with your carbs, you know, regardless of what we do with your mm-hmm. total calories, it's just there humming along in the background the whole time. So that's been my take, mm-hmm. and I don't see like muscle loss, you know, with that.
No, that's totally dead on, man. That's not just bro brain, you know. That's what happens in the. It's what the science shows. That's, you know, what the body is doing in safeguarding a set point or a settling point, or when you go beyond the intervention points or whatever model you want to use for body weight and body fat regulation. Is thyroid is one of the primary regulators of metabolism. So the body's going to react. Like when it doesn't have what it needs, it's going to adjust the metabolic rate. And thyroid is one of those hormonal systems that's there.
Yeah. Right?
Testosterone too, you're dead on. Yeah, replace all those things. And I mean, I would love to see, I don't think there's, I'm trying to think if there's anything I can think of that's related, but I'd love to see, and it would be interesting to take two groups. God, I'd love to have twins, right? Get an identical twin study, like get a cohort, you know, and you split them up and they diet down on essentially the same diet and exercise program, whatever. And one, you just replace hormones, right? You just replace those two hormones and see, you know, when you get them down to not just enough to go to stage level necessarily, because that'd be a lot to ask for subjects.
Study.
Unless maybe they're going to get on a stage at the end, but and just see how much of a difference you see. I would think it would be substantial. I know when you got guys that have been on for a while and they come off and they're hypogonadal and maybe they're not really totally aware of how low they are. And then they're not making any gains in the gym. Everything's just stagnant. Would you just put them on TRT? The dose response from going hypogonadal to eugonadal is just tremendous.
Yeah.
So the other way around, going backwards, I think is probably also pretty dramatic.
Yeah.
You know, when dropping down fat and trying to hold on to muscle, I can imagine it, you know, making a huge difference. Like pretty much, I would imagine with those two things, you could probably enhance fat loss 50% and cut muscle loss in half by 50% or even much more, going down into single digits without a doubt. I don't have any on average.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, going back, so did you want to address anything more big picture? Or his next question, which was, you know, we kind of covered use in contest prep. He also talked about, like, should these things be used in off season? When to avoid these things.
So these are the cards you can play when you really want to get absolutely friggin' shredded. And like I mentioned a little while back, we've got all these natural competitors that basically have proven, right? They're demonstrable evidence that you can get shredded without using those things, right? So that's possible. And so if you're someone then who has, let's say you're on gear, not talking about fat burners here, to hold on to muscle mass, you have that advantage in terms of dieting down. So you have all these other things that can come into play. It makes sense to me to use those sparingly. the one thing that natural competitors typically have to do almost universally, I think, unless they're just absolutely genetic freaks, is they have like these 6-9 month diets.
Right? Yeah.
These guys, they go like, they take 2 years off between shows or longer to try to like, especially at the higher levels, and they get like 3 or 4 pounds of muscle, and then they have to spend 9 months just slowly, slowly dieting down. And that's a long time to spend in a hypogonadal, hypothyroid state. Those guys suffer, man. They don't get near the cred for it that I think they deserve, maybe in the enhanced world, but they really suffer. So you can do all these things. So you have these fat burning tools that are available to you. And to some degree, if, for instance, let's just take stimulants, and I think I've heard Justin Harris talk about this a couple of times. Like, he's totally against stimulants in the off season, from what I understand. He may have changed his mind. And I would generally agree with that idea, avoiding those to the extent you possibly can, because they will and can blunt your appetite. Maybe the first month after a show where you're in your post-contest period, or maybe what you might call your – I love it how when people they're like – 10 days after their show and they say off season form. It's like, you just competed 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Right.
You just holding pretty tight in the off season.
It's like off season form. I'm 5%. It's like, it's a good place after having just competed.
Yeah. You're but, all swole up after eating pizzas for the last 3 days. Right, you know,
right. That's a more appropriate, it's like, look, I'm doing a good job with my refeeding after my show. That's cool. Right.
Yeah.
So it makes sense then, if you've been on stimulants for weeks or months, to slowly reverse out of those so you don't crash.
Yep.
Right? So you've got all these things that are in your pre-contest diet that you have to kind of recover from. But using those in the off season means that those cards have been partially played when it's time to diet down.
Yeah.
So that's something to consider. The other thing to consider, if, for instance, you're someone who just genetically tends to put on a ton of body fat, right? Mm-hmm. And let's just take kind of the worst case scenario. You tend to be what Matt Porter called husky.
Yeah.
He used to call it husky body type, right? So you tend to put on body fat easily. Muscle mass really isn't a problem. Eating enough isn't a problem. You work a 9-to-5 job and you've got kids at home that are waiting for you after work. So you get up at 4 a.m. you know, kiss your kids goodbye while they're still in bed, and then you run off the gym, you train in the morning. And so you drink some coffee, you have an ECA stack maybe because it's even simpler, and you just fly out the door. You get your best training at that point in time, and it doesn't impact your sleep because it's so far away from your sleep. By the time it's bedtime, you just crash,
yeah.
Right? That's and this also is helping stave off that body fat accumulation. I talk about a good friend of mine. She was just like, it's amazing. My friend Barb from California.
Okay.
She's on my website. She has there's a PowerPoint upon how to do your own color with Protan. She used to do Protan backstage. She was Jay Cutler's favorite person for putting on color.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah. Way back when she's been around for a while, and she had never taken Yuhimbine before. So she started taking it in the off season. She's someone who could take it before she went to bed. Didn't bother at all. Like, she didn't notice, but it prevented her from putting on lower body fat, which she always had a problem with. She would get pretty big in her off season, and her legs would just get gigantic, and they had a lot of fat on them. So they were so by far the last thing to come in. She took Yohimbine in the off season. It didn't come across as a stimulant to her at all. It didn't cause any sense of, you know, heart fibrillations or heart palpitations or what have you. But it helped her stave off that lower body fat. And then the next year she came in much better, much more easily. So that might be a use in the off season. But if you're someone who typically stays lean and let's take the other worst case scenario, right? You're known for staying lean, you're known for your condition, but you need to get size, and your ego is attached to being the guy who's shredded all year round, and everyone's like, this guy stays lean all the time, and you keep coming in too light on stage or in the wrong weight class.
Mm-hmm.
You need to be able to eat enough to where you're going to get some more body fat put on, and you're just not someone who can pound down the food. Then taking fat burners, especially stimulants that inhibit your appetite, that's not what you want to be doing. You'd want to be probably not doing that, and then getting as much sleep as you possibly can, so you can grow and ensure that you're rested and recovered, and stay away from anything that stimulates your metabolism, because that might be your downfall.
Right.
I think when we were talking about L-carnitine before, the last, and I mentioned someone who I corresponded with who was using L-carnitine and but no thyroid, and they took the L-carnitine out, and L-carnitine blocks thyroid action, and then they started losing weight precipitously.
Yeah.
And like, because they released the brake on their thyroid, so to speak, in this case. So for that person, like having the size, and this was in a dieted down condition, having the size they have, apparently from this anecdote, apparently was partially dependent upon not having a really fast metabolism.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to have a fast metabolism. So take that guy who's like wants to always be single digit body fat percentage. Having that fast metabolism might be the thing that's preventing him from gaining the size that he wants. So he might just basically have a system that is akin to someone where someone actually is hyperthyroid, even though he may not be truly hyperthyroid, where he can't gain muscle mass because his metabolism is so fast. So that person, fat burn is the last thing they want. You want to have all the energy available for the muscle growth. So generally speaking, I think there's got to be a good reason why you'd want to use fat burners, stimulants, in the off season. And the main one really would be if you just absolutely because of your lifestyle or whatever, you can't get a good, you don't get a great, you're worn down when you go into your training. The problem with that is then you're masking your ability to auto-regulate. So you're going into your workout and you're masking your fatigue with stimulants and it could affect your sleep and everything like that. That's of course the main thing to watch out, one of the main things to watch out for.
Yeah.
But then you don't know when you really need a break. So you basically are pushing yourself into an overreaching state unknowingly to some degree, because you're continuing to be able to train harder than you would be able to if you just went into your training. It's like, I mean, sometimes it might be those days you walk and you're like, fuck, not today, baby. I'm going home. I'm going to have a nap with the kids or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
That's what the stimulants will mask in many cases. And I think that can get in the way for people.
Yeah, I would agree with that. How about, I would say one place would be T4 with growth if needed, you know, I wouldn't say, cause I kind of get the vibe that some people see that it's like a mandatory thing. Like, well, I started a couple units of growth, got to get on the T4 with that. I have seen cases though, and I think these cases have increased with, there's a correlation, I think, between good quality generics being readily available on the UGL market and people dosing it higher. I'm seeing more need for T4 while, you know, in an off season, because we're getting T4 that's you know, really funky, really low. That said, when it is needed, I do feel like there's kind of some magic in there for people.
Yeah.
I really think that it works really well if you're using enough growth that you actually need it.
Mm-hmm. And it's just blood work would give you a good idea. Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, that definitely is an exception to it.
And we're talking about like basically a replacement again, you know what I mean? We're not talking about like actually trying to, hey, we're going to try to add this in so that we burn fat. But there is an effect though, I think, where now we can keep that food really, really high and you're just humming along through it between having, you know, 8 units of growth and, you know, a modest dose of T4 in there.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many levers that are involved, you know, with trying to have a good P ratio as you're in the off season.
Yeah.
So, you know, you've got whatever the natural propensity is for your body to put on muscle mass relative to the stimulus you provide and the need for a caloric excess, right? So those two things, like in most studies, like they don't even worry about diet. They might measure it, but they're not ensuring like, okay, one, we're going to have whatever the conditions we are, high volume, low volume, or high reps or more reps in reserve or whatever, we're going to compare these two things. And then we're going to make sure we optimize growth for everyone by doing a baseline period, getting their caloric intake, and then prescribing a diet where they've got, you know, a 500 calorie excess. Imagine a study, it would be really interesting to take a study where you actually have the athletes, the subjects being individually coached and you're optimizing everything, and you have the only parameter that's different being, let's say, the training regime.
Okay.
Because if you've got 12 weeks or 16 weeks, so you do kind of a longer end study, there's all sorts of things that don't get done in these studies, because this is the nature of the question you're asking. It's like, you might deload somebody halfway through. Mm. Well, you know, then everyone will be deloading at different times. But still, you're asking the practical question, are we training 3 reps in reserve versus training to failure? Well, it turned out training to failure had the deload twice during the training period, mm-hmm. but they made better gains, let's say. Not mm-hmm. saying they would or wouldn't.
Right.
And maybe training to failure, you on average, you found you had to increase the diet more because the parameter that you set was an increase in body weight of 1 pound per week. And you shot for that because you adjusted their diet throughout the training study. That doesn't happen in training studies. You know, they just monitor the diet or they don't even pay attention to the diet, and just the training differs. But you want to have your diet in place. So my point being, getting back to our topic, is all these things that you – all these parameters that can be changed is how much – how well you put on weight relative to your caloric excess is a function of you. And then when you throw on top of that, how fast your metabolism is going to change that too. So you take, let's say, 2 people. I'll simplify this. Take 2 people who have just – we'll just kind of assume they have similarly metabolisms that react similarly in terms of increasing their BMR as they get larger and as they eat more.
Yeah.
So the more you eat, just the opposite of when you diet down, metabolism will get faster, right? And then other things can happen. Your NEAT will change, et cetera, et cetera. Let's just take 2 people. The increase in just – basal metabolic rate is the same, but one person has a proclivity for putting on muscle mass and the other person doesn't. One person's got marathon runner genetics, the other person's got powerlifter genetics. So the other person repartitions that energy differently, right? So that's then going to mean, even though they have that same parameter, the same at the beginning, the other person puts on more muscle mass relative to the body fat, because that energy is going where you want it to. But sometimes the assumption – I've gotten questions from people sometimes, like, we just eat in a caloric excess, you know, and all the energy goes into building muscles. Like, no, that's not how it works.
Yeah.
It's how your body – how the muscle cells themselves, the muscle tissue takes on, because of the hormonal changes, the energy changes, the amino acid presentation, and everything that's going on molecularly in terms of adapting to that training stimulus. So someone might take 400 out of 500 excess calories and it goes to muscle building. And the other just is the excess that just ends up spilling over to the muscle, into the fat, sorry. And someone else might take 100 or 200 out of those 500 calories and it goes to muscle building. The rest of it goes to fat. So one person has a great P ratio, putting on lots of muscle, very little fat. The other person doesn't. So then when you add in something that speeds up your metabolism, someone who has that proclivity to take 400 out of 500 calories and put it to muscle building, adding a little T3 might even mean they gain muscle faster. And you see that with guys who add T3 in the off season and they start growing better.
Yeah, they feel under, like growing under better those very specific circumstances.
For them, and they're probably on gear on top and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, and they're probably eating a lot of food.
So, yeah, and eating a lot of food. And then someone else that might be helpful because that T3 might prevent them from gaining as much fat, but they still gain muscle at a much slower rate. So you have to be more careful. So that adds another level of complexity. And all these things interact with one another. And that's why you got to watch what's happening in the mirror, on the scale, in the gym, with your recovery levels and everything else. So yeah, whether you're going to use T3 in growth in the off season, or T3 with your, or T4 with your growth, and all the stimulants, it all matters what's happening to the individual.
Yeah,
that was my point, I think.
All right.
So, let
me see if we have any listener questions here, Scott, that are related to this. Okay. There was one I wanted to kind of address this, if I can find it. He said, thoughts on DMP use in pro bodybuilding. And this isn't the answer, I think, that he's probably like expecting. But I'm going to tell you just a brief story, Scott, that, and this is one of the reasons I wanted to do podcasts. Like, I wanted to make my own podcasts, is years ago, I had done a lot of research on IGF. This is like 2004, 2005. It was really hard to come by back then. And it was a lot more expensive to get like the research grade stuff that everybody is easily getting now. Anyway, through my research and through like me diving in to learn what it did, me looking at what other people are talking about on the message boards, I started thinking that everybody must be using this, that there's the reason that these guys are as big as they are on the pro stage. And I was earlier in bodybuilding. So I was thinking there must be a reason these guys are not looking the way I do, or I'm not looking like them. And I thought that they must be taking things I'm not. And through reading about all the stuff about IGF-LR3, I started thinking, well, this is one of those things. And so I started spending an exorbitant amount of money to get this IGF at the time and using this. And I did, you know, experience some level of results from it, but I still wasn't one of those guys on stage. And then fast forward several years, I heard John Meadows talking. And John was asked what his experience was with IGF. And he said, oh, I never used it. And I believed him, you know, I believed John at the time, and say, huh, so John never used this stuff. And he's like, yeah, they didn't really know a lot about it. This isn't something he really experimented with. And so this light bulb went on in my head, and I was like, okay, so what I had understood, what I thought I was reading, probably like the equivalent of what Reddit is today. You know what I mean? Like, if you want to learn about IGF, you can go to Reddit. You're going to find out so much information. You're going to have people telling you all of these things about how awesome it is. But then you got a guy who's John Meadows size, and John didn't even know what it was. So I realized that a lot of the guys who are what they are, they aren't that lean, in this case DNP, because they're using a compound like that. In fact, I can say that now, having done as many podcasts as I have, I've had the opportunity to become friends with a lot of the guys that I've interviewed and stuff. I can't think of many, really. There are guys that have used it. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying no pros have ever used it. But I would say it's not a popular compound in pro bodybuilding.
Mm-mm. Yeah, I would agree with that wholeheartedly. The stories I've heard is someone tried to use like low dose and they realized it didn't do anything for them compared to how they dieted previously, or someone was a pro and they were behind and they tried to pull out emergency maneuver and it didn't work out for them. Those are the stories I've heard. So, I think that's there's this general tendency I've been seeing, like even in the question, like, this is what the pros do, right? What do the pros do? It's like, first of all, the pros chose the right parents. That's the main thing that they did. You know, they've got their genetics are there. And there are people that become pros in the way that Phil Heath did. I do that why you don't look like a pro talk.
I was thinking of that.
Yeah. Years ago, the first slide in there is I went and looked at the Olympia top 10. And I went back and figured out how long it took them to turn pro. And there were a couple athletes who had some long pauses in their competitive history. When I took those pauses out, it was 2.5 years from first show to becoming pro. That's not so amazing when we, you know, think about people coming pros in bikini or some other divisions. But at this point in time in open bodybuilding, from first show to pro card, that's just crazy. That's just rocketing to the top. But you do have people, and I'm not going to name any names, but you do have people who are at the pro level, and they're playing all their trump cards all at once. They're using high, massive doses of everything. And there are people that get turn pros who have great genetics, and they get into the pro ranks. And it's like, okay, I'm going to be a middle, lower level pro unless I push all those things in that way. Mm-hmm. So you can have guys that are using like minimal stuff and they're just like super responders to everything. They're just ridiculous, right? And then you have guys that dot every I and cross every T. You got the full spectrum at that pro level. But the one thing that they all have is extremely better than average genetics. Otherwise, they wouldn't have gotten to and stayed at the pro level. I'm talking about open IFBB pro bodybuilders right now. They wouldn't have stayed there unless they had great genetics. And the thing that I among the things that they're throwing into that arsenal, DNP doesn't seem to be one that's used that often. You know, Justin had that, like I said, that's a great example. Like, he did it that previous year and they kind of got away with it, and they're kind of monetizing that now as a as something that, you know, you could do. Not something I would do, but they did it. And, you know, and there are people like, you know, STUH, you mentioned, people can go back and listen to those podcasts, you know, who have ways of doing it that they've done, which, you know, have been safe for those individuals. It's just not something like the margin of safety isn't large enough for me to even think about suggesting someone do that.
Yeah. And he didn't even advocate it. He didn't even want to talk about it. We kind of had to pull it out of him because he didn't want people. Yeah. He didn't really think it was a great idea for people to be doing, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't think a lot of pros are doing that. Like guys aren't saying, okay, you know, I'm going to just diet down for the next 8 weeks on DNP. It's not something they're using. The main thing really is you feel just so terrible you can't train hard. And hard training is one of the most, in my mind, one of the most important things for holding on muscle mass. If you can maintain your training performance, lifting the same loads for roughly the same reps with the same form as you get into the last 3 or 4 weeks before your show, you're going to hold on to your muscle mass or maybe even grow depending on how you do all the other things. But that's what you got to have in place. And if you're taking something that makes you feel like crap and you just can't train hard enough, then it doesn't really matter. You can't produce that stimulus to maintain the muscle mass you have. And, you know, you lose all the fat and you're better at that, but without the muscle, it's not bodybuilding. It's a poor stage performance, I think.
Yeah. I think a good equivalent when you said like at the time it was really hard, you know, it was a lot harder to turn pro. Took 2.5 years for the average guy in that lineup to turn pro.
This was the top 10 Olympia. This is the best of the best. Yeah.
Yeah. Now I would say those guys are like the guys who are immediately a threat when they turn pro in open, like Nick Walker.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like Nick Walker turned pro and he was immediately a threat in open bodybuilding. You know, he's one of those guys that, you know, he has genetics I definitely never did.
I could even pull up that list of people. They're all, everyone is a name, you know, they've all won numerous pro shows. In that particular year, I think 6 of them ended up being Mr. Olympias.
Yeah.
Something like that.
That's wild.
It was like, or were already, it was Dexter Jackson and Big Rami and Phil Heath.
Dexter never had Jalen Roden. Dexter didn't play all his cards out the gate because he had to do it for for 28 years or something. You know what I mean?
It's a great example.
Yeah.
And Dexter also wasn't doing cardio until like the last few years of his career. And, you know, and like he brought his legs up supposedly using an EMS newbie unit too that, you know, played in the last like 2 or 3 years before he retired. His legs kind of like, okay, his legs are going downhill and now he's in a great spot.
Yeah.
So, you know, and I don't think Dexter was, you know, just banging everything he possibly could.
No. He would have quit before that. I know he would have, you know?
Yeah. I know a pro who was known for just having, it wasn't Flex Wheeler, it wasn't Dexter, but it was someone on that level back in the 90s, early 2000s. One of the best posers ever, if not the best.
Okay.
And it's not Kai Greene, just absolute amazing poser. And I remember I was in conversation with him and another person, and man, he's like, I just hate doing these damn injections. Like he hated doing it. He was always missing his shots.
Yeah.
Like, never doing his stuff. He's like, fuck this, man. I haven't done a shot for like 2 months and he still looks like crazy. He's probably hypogonadal. The genetics were just off the chain with these guys.
Yeah.
So a lot of them, and that actually is something that helps with longevity. Like I'm sure Dexter, you know, people would have been amazed by how little he used.
Yeah.
I know they would be, and they probably, most people wouldn't believe it. So.
L-tyrosine in the off season during a bulk phase, year round. What do we think about that?
Yeah, I think it's totally acceptable.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's in a lot of pre-workouts nowadays, L-tyrosine is.
It is, for that reason, as a precursor.
Yeah.
You know, and that's not like, it's just, you know, it's just amino acid. There's no negative side effects. As long as maybe if you start taking like 50 grams of it at a shot,
yeah,
it should be pricey, but yeah, that would make sense. See if it works for you. On an empty stomach seems to work best for most people to have sort of a sense of energy or well-being. So,
yeah. Seeing if we had anything else, cause I feel like we covered a lot of this stuff, you know,
there was a question from the last, I don't know if we have time for it today. It was from the last video about holding on to gains that you freshly acquired in the off season before dieting down. How those gains.
That's a great question.
Yeah. Do you remember that? It's in the, there wasn't too many comments from the last time. I dug it up. You had mentioned other comments. I'm like, oh, that's a good question. There's, I have an answer.
Okay, let me see if there's one more here. He says, I never woke up hypo and never stayed hypo for that long. So 8 a.m., I woke up at 5 a.m. shaky and sweaty going hypo. This feeling stayed for an hour. And even when I got up of bed and took 3 IU's growth, did my fasted cardio, it didn't go away until 7 a.m. when I ate my first meal. I never woke up hypo and never stayed hypo for that long. What does that mean, though? Is it a good sign, meaning that I'm quite sensitive, or could it be an issue? So it sounds like he had low blood sugar overnight, fasted, right?
And
it sounds like his blood sugar was just real low.
Was he using long-acting insulin or something?
Yeah, I don't think so. He didn't say anything about that.
Questions here on the live stream?
Yeah, Raiden Sky.
Okay, let's see here.
I figure, and then let's, after that one, let's end on the question about retaining muscle size, freshly gained muscle, because I think that's a great topic.
Oh, yeah. I did a refeed, 400 grams carbs in my last meal at 8 p.m. He woke up at 5 a.m.
I missed that post.
Yeah, that's reactive hypoglycemia.
Yeah.
I get that. I get that like all the time.
Me too.
The way, yeah, like just like now, like doing nothing. If I miss like a mid-afternoon meal, so normally I'll get up, have something to eat. I'll train roughly about this time of day, maybe a little earlier. I have a podcast or consult or whatever, and then I'll have a big meal.
Yeah.
And then about 4 or 5 o'clock, if I haven't eaten at like 3, I'll start to go hypo a little bit. And it passes quickly. But yeah, that's reactive hypoglycemia. So that's from that big ass meal. So he could add some fiber in there, or maybe change the types of carbs he's eating to something that's got a lower glycemic index, and probably avoid that.
He has zero carbs on his off days. I see it was multiple posts that he made. 200 carbs on training days. Yeah. Did a refeed of 400 carbs. So yeah, that makes total sense to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. So that question, I don't know if you want to pull it up or I can just,
I don't have it offhand, but so the topic though, it was how to retain muscle, like how to retain freshly gained muscle mass.
The question, was if actually there's any research or studies to this, addressing this phenomenon where people will make new gains as the off season goes on. So at the end of the off season, they gain a new amount of muscle mass. And then they lose that when they go into their diet if they don't spend some time trying to hold it, right? And that's been around for forever. Like, you got to hold those gains, right? You got to solidify those gains.
Yeah.
And my thought, as it's kind of simple, but my best guess, because there's nothing to that I know of in the literature. That's too much. That would be such a long study to do to follow people, and shifting their diet around. Like, that's so bodybuilding specific. It'd be a great study to do, but you'd have to, you know, have a whole bunch of people. And then if you got the new gains with them that are already advanced, and then take those who did and just study them or select them out afterwards, like, that'd be a very hard thing to study, but the phenomenon does seem to exist. And my big take on this generally is that, you see studies, there's still some arguments about the importance of satellite cells as far as muscle growth, hypertrophy in the long run. And the idea with the satellite cells, they're responsive to muscle injury. They also get called into play during muscle hypertrophy. There's this long-standing nuclear domain theory. The satellite cells, they multiply, and so they leave a reserve behind, and that extra satellite cell becomes a nucleus in the growing muscle cell. Just like post offices in a growing city, you have to have a certain density of post offices in the city to service a certain area of the city, right? So if the city is getting bigger, you need more post offices. The muscle cells getting bigger, you need more satellite cells, right? Or you need more nuclei, and those come from the satellite cells. But there are some studies, various animal models, even humans, where you can see that you don't have an increase in the number of satellite or number of nuclei in the skeletal muscle, although it's gotten significantly bigger. 20% or so, something like that. You know, you can see up to 20% increases in and muscle cell cross-sectional area without any apparent impact of satellite cells. But in the long haul, and even when you look at in the short-term studies, the more satellite cells you have, the more output of those local factors that turn on the satellite cell activity, and the more satellite cell density you end up with in the muscle, the better off you are in terms of muscle growth. So in the long haul, when muscle cells are getting really, really large, like you'll see in some but not all the studies of more advanced bodybuilders, you need more nuclei. Those come from the satellite cells. So the way I sort of envision it, like taking those, piecing those things together, is you've got muscle growth that's occurring, and then maybe there's some sort of a threshold phenomenon where eventually when the cell starts to get so much larger, the satellite cells have to eventually start producing more nuclei. So a city that goes from 31 to 32,000 people, you don't need more post offices. But when you go to 38,000 people, now that's another 8,000 people. You need another post office somewhere in there, you know, be localized to the area of growth of the city. But just in this, in the muscle cell, you need more satellite cells. But there's a period of growth without that. So if we keep growing and growing and growing, the growth.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Wait, I hear
you're back now. I know, you're back now. Did I completely cut out?
Yeah, you did. You said you said there's a period of time, the growth.
Yeah. So as you're getting bigger and bigger and bigger, the increase in muscle cell volume across sectional area is going to precede the inclusion of more satellite cells or more nuclei. Yeah. So if you're there at that point where you're getting a bigger muscle cell than you ever had, that growth happens. And then it's not just all of a sudden, whoop, snap our fingers, more got another nucleus there, right? It takes some time for that nucleus to make itself in there. That's a pretty large structural reorientation of the muscle cell to do that. So you get there and you got that size. It's myofibular hypertrophy. The muscle cell is functional, but if you then diet right back down again, you don't have enough time to get the satellite cells that are in there to become nuclei. You don't have this time for the more nuclei. And one of the mechanisms of muscle memory are the satellite cells. Because once you've got those nuclei in there, that's a major restructuring of the muscle cell. It's going to just like, hey, we're staying this big, right? We've got new nuclei in here. So each of those nucleus is taking care of its domain, its little volume that it takes over. So it's gonna act in a way that keeps the muscle at that size.
Gotcha.
There's other mechanisms too, but that's the satellite cell potential contribution to this muscle memory phenomenon. So if you gain that size before the satellite cells have established themselves as nuclei, then you no longer have the muscle memory effect in place, and you start dieting down again. That new muscle cell growth before the nuclei have established themselves is very labile. It's not stable. So then it's easily lost. But if you get it and you hold it and you stay there for 2 to 3 months, right, you've got to your advantage then potentially the nuclei have made their way in. So that's a muscle memory effect. You also, this is, I think, really important too, is let's say you're going along and you're getting stronger and stronger and stronger alongside the growth. You're using loads you've never lifted before. You're squatting 500 pounds or 495, which you've never done before. And then you begin dieting right away. And you had two workouts with 495. And then this is psychological and probably neurological. Now I'm down 10 pounds. I can't handle the 495 anymore, right? It's just that was a brand, like I got 5 plates, baby. Like that's big time. But now I lost that weight. You can tell when you're not as heavy. You don't have the mechanical advantage maybe of the extra fluid that's there and everything else. But if you go up to that weight, let's say your new weight's 250 pounds, and you hold that for 4 months, mm-hmm. right? And you're pushing 495 on your squats for 4 months, right? This is old hat for you, baby. This is, you can do this. You know you got this, right? So then when you drop down and you're 242, you're like, I'm still doing 495.
Yeah.
I own this bitch. She's mine, right? We're going to town, baby. You and me, I'm taking you for a ride. That's how it's going to work. And you hold on to that because psychologically, you know you can do that. It's not like this is newfound territory.
Right.
So I think the satellite cells play a role. There may be some epigenetic things. That's the other mechanism. But there's this neurological mechanism. I think the muscle memory phenomenon where you come back and grow muscle more quickly after having lost it is partially because it's like learning how to ride a bike. You know how to train already. You know how to create that stimulus that produces them. You don't, you're not learning this for the first time.
Yeah. And I actually had a question on that. I had a question.
Yeah.
Me.
Yeah.
Yes,
you in the first row.
So let me ask you this. So, it had to do with that muscle memory effect. So let's say you get to a certain size, you hold that size extended period of time. Then for whatever reason, you go through life changes, you stop training and eating, you lose size. Now, you downsize. Are some of those post offices going to close, or are they going to stay there, basically supporting that infrastructure to bring people back in to town? And it'd be easier to. Is that part of it? Do you think? What do you think happens to those satellite cells?
That's what the animal research shows, is that they persist for months or years.
Years even, huh?
Okay. Yeah. Huh. And so there's a study that came out. I forget his name. He was on the podcast. They recently published some of this stuff. They're looking cross sectionally to see if there's a difference in satellite cell density amongst steroid users or advanced trainees.
Yeah.
And there was really nothing that was clearly evident, but the animal, and if you take a year in a rat's life, that's like X number of years in a human life. The rats might live to be two or three, right?
Yeah.
So that's like decades in human time. But those satellite cells after training will stay. So the muscle cell density will actually go up. The muscle will shrink, but the satellite cells are there. So they're ready to go to town. So let's say you've got, like, instead of having 100 nuclei, keep on calling them satellites. There's actually nuclei when they're inside the cell now. But you've got 100 nuclei, and then you train, and now you've got 150 nuclei.
Yeah.
And then you stop training, you detrain, you still have 150 nuclei. Those nuclei then have a lesser relative load to conduct the protein synthesis actions that are necessary there in that local area. You've got more, to handle the load of the post office, delivering and organizing and shipping of all the packages and letters. It's an easier for each of those nuclei. That's one way to look at it, right?
Yeah.
But that seems, and then when you take those animals that have detrained and then retrain them, they retrain more quickly than it took originally. So that's the demonstration, the muscle memory effect, which we see.
They're ready to deliver that mail when the city grows again.
And you can get that increase in nuclei from when you add steroids to the mix in the animal models. So that's the idea, that you have an advantage that could be very long standing. You used gear for 5 years, and then let's say you stop training. The effect of gear on the satellite cells in itself could mean you have a muscle memory effect that you wouldn't have had otherwise.
Yeah,
it could be because the gear in and of itself does that, or the gear just allows you to get bigger. When you get bigger, you get more satellite cells, probably a little of both. But the gear would give you more satellite cells and then give you an unfair advantage just in general, because the more satellite cells you have, the more nuclei you have, the better off you are in terms of muscle growth and muscle size, generally speaking.
We got Miss Olympia with us, IPB Pro Natalia Coella.
That's cool.
What's up?
Woo-hoo. Welcome. So that's the deal. I think psychologically it's really important. A lot of guys will have this tendency to want to maintain their volume when they're dieting down and maybe drop the loads. And let's just I'll just do an extra set, this sort of mentality. The way I've always thought seems to work better is you don't have the recovery abilities, but if you can rest longer and be as focused as possible and maintain your loads, your training loads, get the same number of reps or close to it with the same weights, you're going to hold onto that muscle. And the research shows in general you can prevent detraining with a lesser frequency and lesser volume of stimulus, just regardless of the exercise adaptation. It's easier to maintain than to gain, basically. So
that makes
sense. But the satellite cells are pretty cool. That's it's a pretty cool phenomenon.
And I like
what's going on.
I like the mail analogy, the post office analogy too. That's a good.
That's
one.
The one that seems to work really well to explain this phenomenon. So, yes, that muscle cells are very unique because they're so giant. They're mononuclear, they're polynuclear. They're not mononuclear like many cells. They just have, like, you know, standard cell from biology class that's got one nucleus in it, the nucleolus, and blah blah blah, the organelles. But muscle cells have nuclei all over the place.
He's asked us three times, Scott. Melanogen 2 as a good fat burner.
Yeah, actually. That's the thing. So first time I used melanotan 2, I just, like, tired of going to the tanning bed. I figured this is probably better in terms of skin cancer risk, et cetera. And I'm like, after I used it for like just a few days, and I'm like, first I could tell my appetite was decreased. And I'm like, I'm getting leaner. It's not just from getting Skip put a post up, is on Facebook and Instagram. He was just a picture of him, his head, his face. He's at the beach. And it says, "Remember, brown fat looks better than white fat." So I was made me think of that. It's like the melanotan obviously makes you brown. I think there's some outward possibility that Ken might use melanotan. I don't know.
He's
a Melana brother. Yeah, I'm just joking.
Yeah, he's. I'm surprised he doesn't have his own company for melanotan. Skip's melanotan.
I know, right? He should. Yeah. Skip tanning, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
His own way of doing it, whatever. So that kind of helps with your look. Obviously, that's why people, you know, put pro tan or whatever on when you go on stage. But and the animal research shows that. So melanotan binds the melanocortin 4 receptor in the brain. It does turn on the sympathetic nervous system. Inhibits appetite. It has an anorexic effect in rats. So it's, you know, in certain ways, like, it's illicit, right? So it's not prescribable. I think it's like very illegal in Australia, actually.
Oh.
They had a big problem, but they're really strict on so many things.
Yeah, they are.
For a dieting down bodybuilder, it's got a lot of potential advantages because it keeps your appetite at bay. It increases your metabolism. You don't have to go in the tanning bed or go outside. So it helps. It was developed to reduce the risk of skin cancer. So you have that melanin in your skin, which would absorb the UV radiation as opposed to getting into the nuclei of your cells and creating a mutation that causes skin cancer. So it's an anti-cancer drug, as it was developed for. And then it helps with sex drive and erectile function, right? Which tends to go to the wayside when you're 4 weeks out from a show. So it helps, you know, if you've got a partner. And just, I mean, let's just put it this way. Like, I'd rather be horny than not horny, even if I don't have a partner. It just feels better to have a normal sex drive. You feel more alive.
Yeah, yeah.
At least I do, you know. So it has that effect. So it's got lots of positives. Ken documented, I think, that melanotan, when he was living at altitude, may have contributed to high hematocrit for him, polycythemia.
Yeah, that's right.
So that's a negative. I found like one really kind of obscure reference in the literature that could possibly have, because I was looking and I wanted to help Ken figure that out way back when. So there's that possible issue. But yeah, melanotan, it's not known for that, but I'm just like, how can you not tell? Like the people getting the spontaneous boners that last for 8 hours, and like priapism is a risk factor. It's like a problem, negative, it's a side effect that you got to go to the hospital because you had an erection. Yeah, it's like that. It's like, oh, that's cool. It's like, no, that's not cool. It's not cool when it's been 8 hours, right? And you're like, oh shit, it's not a very safe thing. But I'm just really surprised that people aren't noticing. It's like, this is inhibiting my appetite, and I'm dropping weight, and I look leaner. I literally felt like I'm getting leaner. Like I could, like this is, I can just see this in the mirror, and it wasn't just the skin getting darker. So yeah, it has, but that's probably highly variable. You know, I haven't seen the looked in the genetics of that. I don't think it's been studied in humans, but just like with every drug, variable effects. Some people, you know, claim GH is the pro maker drug, right? And some people don't get diddly from it. You know, that could be numerous reasons. But
anytime I had ever used melanotan, I was dieting for a show anyway. So it's impossible for me to tell. Like, oh, I didn't. I can tell you this: it's not like adding Clen. I can tell you that right now. You know what I mean? It's not like adding T3. Those things for sure. There's no question. Like, oh yeah, now I see a massive change. Melanotan, did it add to it? I'm not going to say that it didn't, but I think that I could have still gotten just as lean regardless.
I see a massive change in me personally.
Yeah.
It was like, what the fuck? Like, I was even so, I'm like, okay, what's going on here?
Yeah.
Like, why? Like, this is just badass. It's like, I was just, I jumped three weeks forward in like 3 days.
Wow.
Like, it was something like, I remember it was like within a week. I'm not sure if it was 3 days the first time. Now I kind of expect it, but I was like, I remember thinking, okay, am I imagining this? Like, let's give this another shot. Right. And it may have been to some degree. I mean, maybe I was eating less. I don't know that I, at that point in time, at first I used to count all my calories or anything down. And then in the last decade or so, after 15 years of competing or whatever, I'm like, I can kind of wing this a little bit, you know, it does change your appetite. So you're going to have to regulate differently if you're just going by appetite and feel. But then I'm like, okay, I'm going to look into this stuff a little more deeply and see what I can find on the melanocortin system. And it does. I mean, like, one thing that I think I've seen mentioned, it does make sense. So this is sort of a vestigial system in humans. So it's melanocyte stimulating hormone is what it's an analog of. A melanocyte stimulating hormone, of course, stimulates melanin production in the melanocytes. So that's why you get a brown skin. And there's just the thing that occurred to me immediately was people tend to eat less many people do when it's warmer, right?
Yep.
And it makes sense just from a thermoregulatory standpoint to eat less, have less body fat, because body fat is insulating if you live in a warm environment.
Yep.
So I'm wondering if there's some evolutionary correlates or co-evolved systems of appetite regulation with the melanin or melanocortin system that we're tapping into with this drug, because it makes you brown, protects you against a hot, sunny environment, and protects you against adipose, which would be counter, it wouldn't be helpful for thermoregulation in a hot environment. So it, you know, it does some pretty cool things bodybuilding wise. But watch your hematocrit, you know, Ken.
I'm sold. If I were to use it again, I would want to try the nasal spray version of it. I'm terrible for remembering to take shots. I forget. I've thought about it. I know that the amino site that shall not be mentioned, that I don't use code THINK at, I think they have the nasal version of it. I saw Carl Lenore saying the other day that he started melanotin up nasal spray version. He said something about it improving plaque, something like that.
I don't know how bioavailable the nasal version is. I mean,
just melanotin in general was beneficial for like heart plaque. So
I don't know. I haven't seen that. Yeah. The thing, like, obviously the side effects, you know, the flushing that you get is just nasty.
Yeah. That's why I stopped. Two things I noticed, Scott. So I think it literally, like, I had epigenetic changes from it. A lot of Irish in me, right? Uh-huh. And McNally. I always would burn. I'd always burn. And I used it, like, a lot of it for a three or four years. And after that, I stopped. And then I would just tan. From then forward, man, I just tan. I tan a lot faster. I think a decade later now, I think I'm back to where I was. But for years after that, I would just get, like, a golden brown color instead of turning red. So there was that. But also, I got real sensitive to that flushing and the nausea, and even at like a micro tiny dose. Yeah, it got worse after having used a lot of it, that I couldn't get used to it again. I try to use it again and I just get real sick feeling, and I'd say, okay, I'll take even a smaller dose. And I was taking like next to nothing and I'd still feel it and could never get used to it after that. So I said, I'm going to bin it for now. But
I've never heard that before, because for most people, there's a tachyphylaxis, that flushing goes away pretty rapidly.
Yeah, and it always has.
Then, that's interesting.
Yeah,
I wonder. So, maybe that site, which can't be named, has like the most potent version of that stuff.
Maybe it does. I didn't get it from them, though. This is years back. So
yeah. That's interesting, because that's the thing is, like, people, if you use it for 3, 4, 5 days in a row, you don't even notice it anymore. Like, there's like, I can barely tell that I did my dose. Then you take 3 days off, it's like you're starting all over again. It's just as nasty. Yeah. It's awful. It reverses, you adapt, and then that reverses rapidly in most people. From the animal research, what I could find too is that although you would expect with that tachyphylaxis, so that sort of adaptation, that it wouldn't work as well in terms of the other positive benefits, things we're looking for, but it seems to persist in animals. But that's, animals are not human, so that, you know, could be different.
Maybe that there's something about my genetics I don't know.
It could be, yeah. Yeah. Anyway, it is an interesting, very super interesting compound, but yeah, I think it's totally underrated as a fat loss agent.
Huh. Maybe I'll give it a go again. See what I get. I could use a tank anyway. Stay in the basement all day long on the podcast.
Right.
All right. Let's wrap this thing up, guys. We appreciate everybody who's been hanging out with us. Get Scott's book, right? The book?
Yeah. If you feel like you need it, it'd be awesome.
BYOBBcoach.com. And yeah, man, it literally is. Take you through your off season. Actually, to start out, basically, help to figure out what you want to do in your off season, set those goals, achieve those goals into your contest prep, through your contest prep, and literally take you to the day of water changes and getting on stage. And then after that, post contest, it covers it was a big brain dump. This is a 1 hour or 2 hour show we do. That's like everything. You get all of Scott's knowledge in one place. Yeah. Anyway, yeah. Check it out, guys. Yeah. And, of course, TrueNutrition.com. Use our code THINKOVER there. Supplementsource.ca for Canadians. And, Scott, this is awesome, man. This is a fun topic, and I think that people enjoyed it. If you guys enjoyed this, then definitely, you know, leave us a like, comment, share it with your friends. And if you haven't subscribed, guys, you watch this whole thing, you should definitely hit that and hit the bell. Absolutely. We appreciate you guys. Thank you, Scott.
Cool. Yep. Happy Sunday. Adios.
All right.